CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 109 with Dr. Steve Sarkisian, innovating glaucoma, advancing surgery, and enjoying life. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest. That is Dr. Steve Sarkisian from Oklahoma. Steve, welcome to my podcast.
Well, thanks. Today, I'm glad to be here. This is great.
Now, if you are going to Google about Dr. Sarkisian, just keep in mind, there's another Steve Sarkisian. No, the glaucoma expert does not coach football in Texas.
No, he was just a quarterback, but this is the, you know, every being in Oklahoma, and since he's now the head coach at the University of Texas, I've had every day someone asks me, usually, are you kin to the doctor, to the coach at University of Texas? I'm just like, no. And then, you know, I have to basically tell them that it's like the Smith of Armenia is Sarkisian. So and they're like, well, he pronounces it wrong. I'm like, well, no, we're both wrong. It's probably Sarkisian. You know, Sarkisian and Sarkisian are probably both wrong. And I know this because when I went to Armenia to serve on like a little medical mission thing, the residents at the Malayan Eye Hospital were like, so how are you, Sarkisian? And I'm like, is my nose not big enough for you people? You know, and they're like, no, finally they're, I'm like, is it because I don't have to shave my back? Is that what it is? They're like, no. And they, you know, I'm like, they're like, well, where's your mother from? I'm like, well, my mother's, you know, half Italian and half whatever. And, you know, and they're like, oh, that is it. You are Italian. And I'm just like,
okay,
man, like, really?
Well, you know, so being in LA, we actually have a large Armenian population. I've learned the important things, which is, of course, look at the light. Luisin Nair, so I can tell the patients, look at the light. That's obviously the most important thing we tell them, especially during surgery. But I also learned this one great Armenian saying, which is their equivalent of like, quit bothering me. It's glukas mi hartuki, which literally translates to don't iron my head. Like you'd iron your shirt, don't iron my head. I can teach you that one. That'll be a good one.
Yeah, all I know in Italian and in Armenian is like, shut up, dinner's ready.
Guarda la luce. That's the one
you want. Yeah, it's shut up and dinner's ready. That's it in those two languages. And I'm not accepted by anybody. That's okay. It's good to be a little bit of an outcast, I suppose, and to confuse the folks, but that's fine. Yeah. So yeah, man, I'm so glad to do this with you. We've been friends for a while, and I think we're both sort of you know, we love people. We love disrupt. We refuse to be boring. I think if you and I have something in common, it's the absolute hardened refusal to be boring. Is that fair?
That is absolutely fair. Plus weightlifting. We're both addicted.
Well, that is true. And there is a physicality to being a surgeon.
Yeah. Right?
Like when I was a fellowship director, I would look at if someone was, I would take the person who was an all-American, sports, you know, whatever, tennis or anything over AOA all day long. Because I knew that, like, if your hands and your eyes are well-coordinated, like, you can, right. you will be a resplendent surgeon, especially if you're intuitive. I mean, you've trained a lot of surgeons, too. I mean, you know, the difference between an intuitive surgeon and a non-intuitive surgeon is huge, right?
Right. You
know, it's one of the main things that we don't really talk about, you know, it's kind of a taboo subject because, you know, but look at, you know, like people have talent and then people, they do things over and over again and they get better at it, you know, and some people are just always going to be not so great. We don't like to talk about, you know, that the average surgeon is a competent surgeon, you know, like we're all in the NBA as it were, but not all of us can be Jordan, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not claiming to be Jordan, but you know what I mean? Like, you know, what do you do with a person that does a 3-minute FACO and like, should all of us be judged by his videos, you know, by that surgeon's videos? And, and how do you like, there's no way to address that. And, you know, unfortunately it's the guys with the biggest egos putting these videos up like, hey, you know, I can do this an X amount of time. And then someone from Medicare or something sees it and they're like, you're killing us. You know, oh, well,
you actually want to be slower. So I actually made fun of myself. I put a video up in 2005, so 20 years ago, of me, you know, early 30s, operating, doing Very fast fake out. And then I reviewed the video a few years ago and said, I was a moron. Who cares if it's 3 minutes? If it's my eye, please spend an extra two. Make it 5 minutes and make it prettier than that. But we've obviously changed a bit. But yeah, you're right. No one wants to talk about it in academia, especially. There's a bell curve of surgical skill. Like, there's a bell curve for everything else in life.
Right. The best surgeons are not in academia. You know, I mean, I say this. Well, you just left academia, didn't you? Or you're kind of only academia adjacent now or something.
Well, I did for 22 years. I did part-time private practice, part-time professor at UCLA teaching the residents of the county hospital. And that was a large portion of what I did. But 3 years ago, I actually retired from that at 52. So now I just do my private practice, and I teach the world with Cataract Coach.
I love it. I love it. And which is just such a tremendous resource. And
you also left academia. So you finished a glaucoma fellowship at UT, University of Tennessee, Hamilton Eye Institute. They loved you so much. They said, hey, by the way, we're nailing your foot to the floor. You're staying right here as faculty. And then after a few years, you left, went to Oklahoma. And for a dozen years, you were a glaucoma professor there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and it was a weird time to be in academics, but I think it was, they knew to just let me be me. I think that's how it worked is, they knew that, I mean, part of the reason that they brought me on there was because they knew that I was going to, I don't know how well they knew this, but they think they had an inkling that I was going to break stuff, you know, and by breaking stuff, I mean, like, by changing paradigms. And
right.
And they knew this because, you know, in 2003, Peter Netland and I, Peter Netland, who was my fellowship director and who's now chairman of EVMS, we started doing the expression under a scleral flap, you know, and you would not believe the forces of mediocrity, or I don't know, like I don't want to,
the old dogma, say, the old mindset.
Yeah, I don't want to say axis of evil, but I mean, there was a bunch of people that came out and were like, you're putting a nail in the eye, I'm gonna shut you down, what you're doing is wrong. Now, they wouldn't necessarily, people have a way of not giving me crap to my face, but you know, it's you know, it all comes back to me, you know, you know, it's kind of interesting. But I'm like, you know what? And I learned this from Peter. I want to do things more safely. Like, if there's a thing, you know, I mean, you have see enough eyes go blind from trabeculectomy. 7 to 10% of severe glaucoma eyes that have split fixation will lose fixation with the trabeculectomy.
Yeah.
Let me say it again. 7 to 10%. It's a big freaking number. And people are like, oh, just do a trab. Well, if you have severe glaucoma, you don't want to have a dangerously low pressure, especially in the early postoperative period, you know? And so with the Express, it went from a 500,000 micron hole under the flap with the sloppy 3 Kelly punch, whatever, to a fixed lumen. And, you know, you still need to sew the flap down, but it still controlled the flow so that a pressure of 6 with an Express shunt under a flap was different than a pressure of 6 with a trabeculectomy. Mm-hmm. And it was just safer. And Peter and I published that data, and it demonstrated that the rate of hypotony was 5 to 7% with the Express and 11 to 15% with the trabeculectomy. And it was a big deal, and it got Alcon's attention. So we went from being pariahs to when Alcon bought Alftanol, then we became prophets. It was like, oh, yeah, Steve knew this all. Yeah, that's great. You know, but for me, it's never enough. So then the next step was ab sternocanaloplasty, you know, that was like the next, you know, the extension of viscocanalostomy, where we were doing, you know, which I actually never did viscocanalostomy. We talked about it, you know, and I remember my fellows were like, well, maybe someone that's got, you know, a small eye and high risk, you would need high risk for suprachoroidal hemorrhage because they have a thick sclera or something. Maybe they would be the one you do, but we never did one. But then, you know, canaloplasty came out and that was the next step, you know, and it was just a small number of us, you know, sort of, you know, I don't know what to call us.
Renegades.
Crazy Jedi Knights, you know, really, because it was a hard surgery.
Right.
But if you look at the list of people that were canaloplasty surgeons, ab external canaloplasty surgeons. Those were all the guys and gals that ended up being the guys, the folks that start, that did, were all in all the early clinical trials for the MIGS procedures. Yeah, yeah. So it was like a movement in that direction. And they accept the canaloplasty. But once we started doing, you know, iStents and CyPass, and, you know, and it's weird when you're the first one in the world to do something.
Right.
You know, the CEO and the medical director and the engineer that designed the TRAP 360 device, like, you know, basically sought me out to like be the first to do their TRAP 360. And I'm like, sure, bring it out, come on out. And, you know, we just kind of did it, you know, and I asked for forgiveness later, you know, like, but, you know, it was hard for like the fellow and the other people to like sort of process what was happening.
Right.
Sure. This okay? I'm like, well, sure, it's okay. You know, this is just it's just like a scalpel. It's just like me using a different scalpel. I'm not leaving anything in the eye, you know. And you know, these poor guys were, you know, like this, you know, shaking in the corner, like this is, they pour all their lives into this. And I'm just like, yeah, I got like four or five cases, let's go. You know, and you know, and I think we went to Jimmy John's or something for lunch. I mean, it was like some inauspicious thing, sure. But it was like this groundbreaking thing, and I just kind of like let it pass me. I'm like, what do we got today, you know? And it was awesome, you know, and to be a part of that. And then of course the Visco 360, you know, in 2014, you know, they were like, we're gonna do this with viscoelastic instead, you know, and do it from the inside. So somehow I guess it was me that was the first in the world to do ab interno canaloplasty, right. Because
right.
It wasn't called that, it was Visco 360, but that's what it was. You know, and then that eventually became the Omni, where they put the two things, one catheter that did both goniotomy and viscodilation. And, you know, it's cool stuff. You know, I mean, it's one of those things that just, you know, and then I'd say, hey, you guys got to try this. And, you know, it, you know, we've seen just tremendous results with that. But being a sort of first adopter is kind of trippy.
Mm-hmm. You
know? And it's also like, you know, with when you're being like, you know, first to do certain IOLs and things, or being, even if you're the first one in your state, it you can't overthink it. Like you can't drink your own Kool-Aid, you know. Yeah. Like it's a blessing to be privileged enough that your people trust the work of your hands. Your right. hands have been blessed, that people trust you, that you're not going to mess it up. If things don't go right, you're not going to crap on the company or say, oh, this is terrible. Like, right. No, you're going to try to be like, well, how could I have done that better? You know, and you're going to try to always be improving. And that's why when you talked about, you know, seeing a video from 20 years ago and like, holy cow, you know, okay, here's a story. I was at, I was smoking a cigar with Robert Stegman in Chicago. Robert Stegman was the inventor of canaloplasty, visco canaloplasty. He's from South Africa.
South Africa, yeah.
And we were smoking Monte Cristo number twos, which I won't explain how we got those, but you know, we were smoking those. And I leaned over to him and I said, and it just kind of occurred to me. I said, Robert, can I ask you a question? He's like, yes. Mm-hmm. I said, do you feel, and he was in his early 70s at the time. I said, do you feel like you're still getting better as a surgeon? Like, do you feel like, you know, you're still improving? And he looks, we were the only ones there. And like, he looks around. he goes, yes. And I was like, okay, good. Because I feel that. Like, I feel right. like every 6 months, I feel like I'm a little better.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is trippy, right? Like, that in our 50s, we're like, you know, we still feel like, man, I'm kind of figuring this. I'm like, you know, I'm getting pretty good at this, you know?
Right. For sure.
And I say that with fear and trembling, you know, like, because I appreciate, like, you know, but I hope but that's like our whole lives, right? Like there's a restlessness to always be better and always come up with something that's right. safer for patients that'll right. make their lives better, you know? And it's, I feel like a motor in me constantly, like, how can we do this better?
We always want to learn more. I always want to push the envelope, learn more, be an early adopter. So even my experience with ab externo canaloplasty basically was with the residents. I was at the county hospital. We didn't have any fellows other than a retina fellow.
Oh,
and
wow.
I said, and a young resident who's interested in applying to a glaucoma fellowship, and she said she wants to try this new procedure. It just came. I'm like, sure, let's do it. So we started doing it. And so, like, following your model there, don't ask permission. Just do it, and then ask for forgiveness later if there's an issue.
Yeah, my wife rolls her eyes when I say that. She's just like, yeah.
But, you know, I think there's an important point, too, as well. But sometimes in academia, they are really stuck in the old paradigm of the way of doing things, the old mindset, as Osher would say, the old dogma. And sometimes when you push the envelope too much, you get a lot of grief. Remember, IOLs were called a ticking time bomb in the eye by a lot of academic people for many years. Like, never put an IOL in the eye, leave the patient aphakic. Yet those people who said that ended up getting an IOL in their own eyes.
Right. Well, it was a scam, right? I mean, those guys had it good. They had a nice optical deal going on. They were getting paid for aphakic spectacles and aphakic contact lenses, which I suspect was a large part of this, was that they were going to lose a large revenue stream, you know, maybe that's my theory as I kind of, no one's told me. I'm just thinking that might be part of it, but I think about this all the time. This is actually really like, and I've asked lots of the leadership at, ASCRS and other just kind of like, hey man, I think our story is being lost. Like, I think the story of how, like, this should be a Hollywood movie, right? You know, the IOL story and the phaco, I mean, Charlie Kelvin story is really compelling too,
but the amount of grief he got.
And it's you know, it's these forces of mediocrity and these four, you know, forces of darkness, where you have this cabal of people that just don't want, they're fearful of their own livelihood. They're fearful. I don't think that they're fearful of hurting patients. I don't, because if you think about it logically, it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That should be a good goal. Helping people see at the time of cataract surgery with a lens, that would be a great idea. Let's figure out how to do that well. Right. But no, it was like he was basically almost criminalized and blackballed back when people could be blackballed. Now they're canceled, but they're not really canceled. But, you know, people would legitimately blackball people. He was blackballed.
That means if you don't have at least a few naysayers, you're doing it wrong. If everyone loves you and you're doing an over-egregious patch on the back, you're probably not doing enough to push the envelope.
Right. I'm never the first guy that a company wants to, I'm the first guy they want me to do things, but I'm never the first one that they ask to do like a speaker program or something. Sometimes I am because I have unique perspective, but you know, but because they don't, because I'm going to tell the truth, right. You know, and if someone says something really stupid, you know, like I'm going to be like,
let me ask a question.
You know, and here's why you're wrong. You know, Paul Singh and I were talking about this because, you know, Paul is so brilliant and such an effective speaker. And in fact, he was explaining to our wives our differences, you know, and he was like, well, you know, if something comes up and it's like, you know, and I admittedly, it's not something, you know, it's usually something that's not like a hill you die on per se, but you know, or Paul will say, oh yeah, you know, that's, you could do it this way. Yeah, that's not a bad way. You could do it that way, sure. And I'm like, no, you don't want to do it that way. Don't do it that way. And here's the 10 reasons why you don't want to do it
that way. Well, he's such a sweetheart. He don't want to step on your toes. So he'll,
you know, you're right, right. And so, like, that's always going to be, and you want that guy on the dais, you know, like, you know, you want him on everything, you know, and that's why he's on everything, because he's so uniquely gifted, you know, but you know, I'm the guy that like is the hammer. Like, I'm like, do you need me to like say something? You know? Do you need me to say something? Because I will, and we'll get results because I am, you know, logic on fire.
But you know, I think we need that though in order to push the envelope. Because I just think back to how I was trained for glaucoma, which was in my training, hammer the eye with drops so there are at least four or five different drops, which means they're using a drop every hour. Their entire day is spent putting drops in. And then maybe down the road, once the eye is a hot mess, now go ahead and try to do a tube or a trab and then put the toxic mitomycin, let that cause lots of issues and deal with all that. And then just watch them carefully as the vision slowly fades out. That was, it seemed like that was what the dogma was.
And that's still the prevailing dogma in academics, circling back to academics. I mean, I hold precious memory in my time in academics. I mean, I was always frustrated, not by the ability to practice the best medicine, actually.
Right.
I was frustrated by, you know, the way the process was, and the fact that if there was an employee that was not doing things the way I wanted them to be done, they were protected somehow.
Yep.
And if they were people that weren't particularly great with patients or would say inappropriate things, like, I had no power to fire those people, and they would just put somewhere else, you know. And it occurred to me eventually that it wasn't fair for me to expect everybody to have my standards of excellence. But this was kind of a revelation, you know, like, because, you know, is it fair to expect everyone to be able to keep up with me? I mean, really, you know, and have my shared values?
Private practice, you can.
I could make people share my values. Right. In academics, I couldn't. And so, you know, I was like, you know what? It's not these people's fault. It's not their fault. Like, this is my fault for still being here. You know, and I need to, like, you know, and so it's been people are like, oh, but you know, people get sick of, like, the details and the running of everything. No, I love that stuff, man. Like, yeah, I have so much fun, like, trying to, you know, run you know, have things be good, and even like how people answer, how the phones are answered.
Yep.
You know, like, it's a great day at Oklahoma Eye Surgeons. My name is, how can I make your day better? That's how they answer the phone in my office. Go for it. But I mean, how can I make your day better? And it blows people's minds, because they're coming, like, they're upset about a billing thing, and then they're like, well, I was upset about this, but, like, well, you know, you guys are having such a great day. I'm going to have a great day too. Yeah. Thank you for that. But those are things.
It's a big step for you to be in the university for, let's say, a dozen years, and then to say, you know what? I got to change gears.
14 years in Oklahoma and you know, 2 years in Memphis. So, yeah, I mean, it was I've still spent more time in academics than in private practice. But it's such a joy even being able to, even with the declining reimbursements, you know, like, there are ways to be efficient, and there are ways to constantly be inventive. And, you know, and really what I'm able to do, I was one of the busiest premium cataract surgeons in the university with zero. Like, if someone said, I want Dr. Sisson to do my cataracts, they would be told, Dr. Sarkisian doesn't do cataract surgery. Never mind that I was one of the highest premium cataract surgeons in the place as the glaucoma guy. So now and again, no, you know, like, precious memory, good people.
Yeah, of course.
You know, but, you know, I, you know, now it's like a huge feature of my practice. You know, I mean, I ended up first year in private practice being the first in the state to do the PanOptix lens, and
cool,
things like that just kind of happened because I was like, I was there. You know, and there's this, you know, it just kind of, so I own two femtosecond lasers, you know, which is like owning two Ferraris.
Well, the lasers cost more.
The lasers do cost, you know, it's like, I love it. I love every part of that. It's so much fun to be able to, you know, and then really that's the culmination, is the premium cataract surgery combined with, especially for mild glaucoma or ocular hypertension, some type of, you know, MIGS procedure.
Yeah, for sure.
But even that's really controversial because, you know, I think when I was on the ASCRS glaucoma committee, we wrote a white paper about visual outcomes and MIGS, and basically showed that there's no real difference in the visual outcomes between cataract surgery alone. So it begs the question, like, you know, for sure we should be fixing everyone's astigmatism that has glaucoma, even if they have severe visual field loss, you know, if they have central vision, fix their astigmatism. But then it's like, well, what about like trifocal lenses in glaucoma patients, you know? And like, there was a meeting 2 years ago that I said, basically presented that, you know, yeah, mild glaucoma, which means, you know, full visual fields, like, you know, if they're controlled, you know, go for it, you know, And you know, and I want to be as minimally invasive as possible. I want to have no chance of bleeding. So, you know, I prefer the, you know, the iStent combined with the, you know, PanOptix if I'm going to do that. And, or, you know, or the trifocal of your choice, right? Sure. I guess a couple things to do now. And, you know, it's, you know, a prominent person, you know, came up and said, you know, I am just so sad that, you know, he didn't call me out by name, but like, cause it was, I wasn't the only panelist.
Sure.
That, you know, with people that have decreased contrast sensitivity that you would, that you would dare like not give them the best resolution possible, you know? And I remember I wanted to be like, well, there's a box, there's six boxes of tissues up here. I didn't mean to make you sad, you know, you know, like, you know, I, if you'd like to come up and have some tissues, that's fine. But, and then it occurred to me like, you know, what did Charlie Kelman say? He said, doctors debate, patients decide.
True. Right? So true.
And, you know, yeah, there is a point, and I do, but I tell my patients that, like I say, you know, if your glaucoma gets worse, you know, this, that you're going to, you know, you may have some, you know, you're going to have resolution issues anyway, right. But they want to read without glasses. Let them decide to read without glasses. Don't be a jerk. Don't be a self-righteous, whatever. And decide for them. The first patient that had PanOptix in Oklahoma was a retired anesthesiologist with a huge superior arch visual field defect, but good central fixation.
Okay.
And I had a long, I was talking with him for 30 minutes about this. And at one evening, I just called him up and I said, here's the deal. He's like, yeah, yeah, I want to be the first one that gets that lens. And I don't, he's like, I'm like, but you know, you got to appreciate that this is going to still have a blind spot. I don't care. You know, he still emails me, you know, hey, doc, just let you know I'm doing great. Thanks so much.
All right.
You
know?
I mean, it did, the first week he was like, well, this one's a little darker. I'm like, yeah, that's your glaucoma, man. Oh, okay. You know, I'm like, do you ever use glasses? No. And I love it. Thank you.
Right.
You know, this guy's happy.
Right.
Like, what are we doing here? Right. Like, it's not about us. It's happy. I think a lot of ophthalmologists don't want to have conversations with patients. They're going to make a decision. Here's another thing that really gets me. If you have glaucoma and you are on treatment for glaucoma, meds, or you've had intermittent SLT, which is my choice, is, you know, I start with SLT, which I still can't believe we're talking about as a, like, should that be a thing? I mean, it blows my mind. You should not be doing cataract surgery alone on people that have elevated that you think that they have real glaucoma. They have a diagnosis of glaucoma and they're on meds, or they have glaucoma and they're you want to do something and they also have a cataract. Mm-hmm. Don't just do cataract surgery. Is not adequate. Yeah, it'll lower pressure, but it doesn't last that long. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Like, do you remember the prostaglandin wars? Like, every millimeter matters. So right. Are you telling me that cataract surgery alone is going to give you as low of a pressure as cataract surgery plus some gentle MIGS procedure?
Mm-hmm.
The evidence is clear that the MIGS procedure plus the cataract surgery will lower the pressure more. Well, is it more better? Why are we still having this conversation? Mm-hmm. And then I get to see all these patients that general ophthalmologists do phaco alone on patients on three meds with visual field loss when they come in with a pressure of 50 and, oh, I don't know what happened. The cataract surgery should have lowered the pressure. Because you didn't address their glaucoma. Cataract surgery is not a glaucoma procedure. You know, it lowers pressure, sure.
Uh-huh.
But now that when all we had was trabeculectomy, fine. Like, I appreciate the phaco alone on someone controlled on meds. That right. I get. Although we did have ECP.
But then that begs the question, is part of the issue that we're not doing like standalone MIGS procedures? Why not do it a stepwise? Let me be devil's advocate for you here.
Right.
Why not do the cataract surgery now? And then 6 months from now, a year from now, you can always go back and do the MIGS procedure. Or is it a billing issue?
That is true. That is true. But what if, you know, and that, I think we're going to see more of that. But why don't, I'd much rather do a MIGS procedure at the time of cataract surgery. Right. And then, because you're in there already, and because, you know, every time you go in the eye, you lose endothelial cells. It might not be a lot. It might not be significant. but you're going to lose some. I mean, you look at all the phacomig studies and the endothelial cell loss, and all those folks started with a cell count of 2,500 to 2,900. And then, you know, all the cataract surgery alone group had cell counts of like 1,900 after just phaco. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what you lose with phaco. And the phacomigs, they were kind of like phacoisin, for example, it was the same. It really was no different. Right. You know, so you're going to lose cell counts every time you go in. And, you know, I have lots of folks where I did phaco iStent, and then I'm now doing phaco infinite in the temporal quadrant. So I have people walking around with five iStents, you know, or you could do ECP, or you could, you know, take one of the stents out if it's in the way and do an Omni, you know, or there's this new thing that Shawnee Anchilov has that is the Cyclopen, that's an Alloflow, the scleral implant that you can put in the, you know, I mean, there's other things you can, there's lots you can do. So, you know, if you're a general ophthalmologist and you don't do all that, you don't want to do all that stuff, do something.
Yeah, for sure.
or don't do it. Like, then send it to someone who's going to do that. You know, I mean, like, there's plenty of folks that need cataract surgery. If you're not going to take care of people correctly or properly, like, it's indefensible. Like, if someone has phaco alone and they lose pressure because they lose visual field because they're being followed like a cataract patient, right. You know, and that's indefensible. You're going to be, you know, if you're standing on trial, like, why didn't you had these things available to you? Did you knew they had glaucoma? Like, why didn't you do these things? Well, I don't know. I don't believe in it. What?
It becomes a challenge there. Now, one of the best things is, even since you've left seven-ish years, you've been in your own private practice, you're very busy, I still see your name on every single glaucoma trial that's out there. So you're probably doing more trials now than before.
Oh, no, for sure I am, because I can control the process. And I can make sure that, like I wasn't hiring whoever was put with me to run the. Now I have this crack team where, you know, they are so good at doing glaucoma trials. You know, really, clinical trials are probably better. I've learned are probably better when handled in private practice anyway. Right. You know, and, you know, we ended up being the largest, you know, recruiter for the iDose, you know, TR study, which was awesome. You know, and it just was one of those things. It worked out beautifully. And you know, but, you know, when you do a lot, you also get compulsory audits by the FDA. So, but, you know, we made it through that beautifully. So there is a flip side to being prolific, is that people are watching, but that's okay. You just got to be, you want to be perfect. You want to have everything be open and available to the most vigorous scrutiny, you know, because you want to practice with integrity so that the results are, like, they speak for themselves, so that without question, you know.
Yeah, I've seen your name on everything. I saw, like, you were on the TVT, right? Tube versus trab trial.
Yeah.
See the Ahmed bear belt comparison.
Yeah.
And then now basically every single possible MIGS procedure, I see your name on it.
Yeah, Express versus trab, primary TVT, you know, those were the things in the beginning. There was a... You know, there was a study I did with the Crouppen valve that became the Eagle Vision valve. Okay. That never really went anywhere. That was one of, like, my first forays in being the primary investigator in a trial. And I got a bunch of my friends to try, and it just never really kind of went anywhere, but mostly because that mechanism was not that great. But yeah, you know, the iStent Infinite, the CyPass, which is still upsetting. I'm still upset that I get it. But I have all these people walking around with, like, amazing pressures after phaco CyPass. And I did a few off-label standalone CyPass, and they're doing amazing, and their corneas are fine. But, yeah, if I left it too long.
Yeah, but sticking out.
You know, it was a problem, and so I've clipped my share of those too. But I wish they would have changed the directions for use and re-released it, because I have a lot of people who are not blind because of the CyPass. And I don't think we'll ever see it. I don't think that it'll ever happen. But, you know, Alcon, we're moving onward and upward, you know, like the DSLT now. We were among the first to do DSLT in America. And that thing is fun. That is, you know, you it's different because the patients are standing up. But here's the thing, when I talk to patients, is that it's a perfect laser every time, because right. even if the patient moves their eye around, it tracks with them, and it's 120 spots, perfectly evenly spaced. Right. Like no human being can do that.
Yeah, of course.
Like no human being can do that. And so like I would do 100 spots, you know, with, you know, and just because I'm like, yeah, it's about 100. Yeah, 100 gets me around 360. Right. Well, this is 120, you know. So we'll see.
Data is good. Perfect. The
data is good. And you know, and we've had a lot of fun. But what I've seen with that is like I used to do 15 to 20 lasers in an afternoon. And you know, now I'm doing 30 and getting done sooner. You know, and
so why aren't more surgeons saying, start with first line treatment, let's do an SLT? Why are we even going into the debate of let's use drops first? Why?
There's multiple reasons for it. And we'll go over a couple of them. One, people are victims of their training.
Yeah,
they're victims of their training, right?
Well, they never have. They don't have to be.
They don't have to be, but they are, right? I mean, they are. And, you know, a lot of, especially the non-intuitive people, the people that are like cut three times and, you know, measure three times and cut once, you know, and like, I remember I had a fellow that like, I never met when I put in a tube, I never measured how far back the plate is. Like I know what 9 millimeters is. Like I know my, and he's like, you don't measure. You're like, how do you know? Like, this is not right. And I'm like, get your caliper and say,
right.
I'm like, that's 9 millimeters. No way. Measure it right now. Do it. And then I made him do it for like the next five tubes. I'm like, get your calipers. So like the, you know, those guys will never get it. But
is that your way of saying get your shoe shine box?
You know, I mean this with humility. Like it's being able to do that. It's a gift. It's not something. But I mean, don't tell me.
It's a
don't tell me I'm wrong because no, it's I.
It's a learning.
Don't tell me I'm wrong
for
doing something you can't do. You know, but they're victims of their training, and I did my duty to try to correct that. You know, for the people that I train, and then you know, this is a little more controversial, but you know, the House of Medicine has been bought and sold by Big Pharma, and you know, I'm not saying pharma is evil, but you know, they have a vested interest to make the grease the wheels so that you know the departments are funded well by pharmaceutical dollars, and so the paradigm of pharma first, medical medicine first, is in every subspecial, and you know, especially the specialties that could go that are mixed medicine and surgery are always going to get, you know, but they're getting it, they're changing, especially because a lot of these companies now also have a rigorous glaucoma surgical program, you know, and so they're getting the, you know, I think they're gonna not divest them, but you know, if you have a new drug, they're going to be pummeling that, but all their old drugs that are mostly generic now, you know, they have the luxury of changing their tune, you know.
Right.
And so that I think that's a large part of it as well. And then part of it is just fear. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean it depends on where you practice. Like, you know, I'm blessed to practice in a part of the country where my patients kind of do what I recommend. You know, I love it when they don't. I love it when they ask questions, you know, like, because if they ask questions or taking notes, they own it, mm-hmm. you know, then, you know, cause people just say, yeah, sure, whatever you say. But then they just, you know, then you ask them a month later, like, you know, what are you doing? What drops are you taking? They're like, oh, I don't know. Like, you know, they don't know, you know? And then I think that there's a little bit of pride involved in some of this, because I think a lot of doctors don't really believe the compliance data. And the compliance data says, quite simply, that perfect compliance is 10%.
Wow. That's like 1 out of 10 patients has actual perfect compliance?
Perfect compliance is 10%. Mm. Now, you know, I mean, we have all these pharmacy studies that show that 50% of people don't even get their prescription refilled.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Ugh, can you imagine? Yeah.
Right. So, and you just look up study after study. Now there's compliance. There's some compliance, you know, like doesn't mean people aren't taking their drops at all. You know, they might take them when they take them when they remember them, or they take them the week before their visit, you know, because, you know, they want to make you happy. They like you. Right. You know,
that's like me. I can't remember taking vitamin every day. So I take it whenever I remember. And then before I see the dentist that week before, I floss really well.
Right. Right. It's the same thing. So I think a lot of doctors have this sort of part like, oh, well, no, my patients.
Right.
They listen to me. They do what I say. I mean, they listen to me. You know what? Half the patients don't even know who did their cataract surgery.
Right.
I'll ask patients, oh, who did your cataract surgery? Oh, I don't know. I remember they can think, I can think of his face. Well, you know, and this is very humbling because this is, and you know, I don't get upset. I'm like, you know what? This is a good check for myself.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Like I'm not all that. I will be forgotten.
Of course.
You know, there are patients that will not remember my name a month from now, let alone 10 years from now. No one will give a crap about me in 50 years, and I don't care. That's fine.
If I want to be humbled, I always just talk to my kids. They'll tell me how little I really know.
Oh, no, that's the best. I mean, you know, I have, you know, four kids, and you know, only I got two teenagers left, but the others are older, and you know, that but you know, the teenagers are happy to tell me, Dad, you're not as funny as you think you are. Right. You know, although I usually win, you know, because I'll like do some funny voice or something and just be with it until they.
Well, I heard a good pearl for helping to convince a patient that they should do SLT. They have resistance right off the bat. Give them a drop like dorzolamide. Tell them to use it three times a day for a month. Come back in a month. And then ask them, how'd you do over the last month? Were you able to get all three drops in every day for the last 30 days? Do you want to continue that the rest of your life, or should we do the laser? And they're going to raise their hands and be like, please do the laser now.
That is a good one. And then the other is, you know, you could show them the data. Like, I think, you know, we have really good sleep study data now. And, you know, like the light study that, you know, I mean, it shows actually that primary laser trabeculoplasty is not equivalent to eye drops. It's superior to eye drops, not just because of compliance, but because of how it flattens the diurnal curve. There's something about that 24/7 pressure lowering that, like, it's a superior treatment. Furthermore, to, you know, to talk about sustained release, you know, the implantable pharmaceuticals.
Oh, like travel plus. Sure. That you were instrumental in that study.
Right. You know, and I did a bunch of Durista too, you know, and that, you know, there is data that shows that, you know, they're not equivalent. Topical travoprost and iDose TR are not, you know, equivalent. That actually the pressure is a little bit better with the iDose TR. And so, but not only that, if you have continuous medicine inside the eye, that will always be better than pulsing it once a day, even with perfect compliance.
Right.
So, and the dose is so much, just the amount of the dose is so much smaller because it's right there. You know, if you think about it, like each one of those is this equivalent of like 2,080 eye drops.
Wow.
Each eye dose is the same as 2,080.
Wow. That's when you put it that way. Wow. Right.
And then, I mean, you know, and I've seen how they're made. I mean, they're like, it's like honey. You know, almost the consistency of the pure preservative-free ISTR. And the other thing, people are like, well, you know, what if they get allergic? You know, the eye is kind of an immune privileged space in there, right? Right. And it's anchored, it doesn't move, there's no cell loss. I mean, I have patients going out almost 8 years having had iNose. And, you know, there's no cell loss. Some of them will get, there's a 4% rate of iritis that's treatable easily. And, you know, like it's a remarkable thing. And, you know,
that be the future protocol then for, let's say, a milder case, an implantable travoprost delivery every 5 to 8 years?
I think that's going to be, I think that the standard of care is going to change fairly rapidly, where I think primary SLT for some, but I think there's going to be a lot of people getting primary primary iDose. Many of my patients in the clinical trial were totally naive to therapy.
Wow.
They never had anything.
Wow. So their first glaucoma therapy ever.
I diagnosed them and I put them in the trial. And those were some of the best patients. Like, they did amazingly well. If someone's been on a topical prostaglandin forever, like, that's a different kind of patient, because all the uveal scleral outflow is kind of, it's already been messed with a little bit, you know? Mm. And, you know, same thing with laser trabeculoplasty. If you have a virgin eye that's never had anything, not that's even an eye drop, yeah, and you laser trabeculoplasty, we're seeing, you know, 50% drops in pressure. Like, mm-hmm. I've had virgin eyes with pressure of 35 be 15.
Whoa. Know?
Yes. Wow. Yes. You know, and it's incredible. There's a big difference between a virgin eye and an eye that's been on eye drops forever.
And then you eliminate the issue of, like, what we're seeing, right, with the pigmentation of the eyelids, with the loss of orbital fat, the ptosis or the
eyelid. Periorbital fat atrophy is something that, it's kind of funny. Like, we didn't really hear a heck of a lot about it during the prostaglandin wars.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it's all we talked about, you know, I remember the ad for Brooke Shields was the first spokeswoman for
Latisse.
And you can't really even find some of those ad campaigns anymore, because it had her before and after, and they wanted to show the longer lashes in the after, but you could clearly see the periorbital fat atrophy in the after.
I'll have to Google that one.
Yeah, you could clearly see it. It was like screaming at you, you know, and so... Yeah, I think they scrubbed the internet for those pictures, but maybe you can find them. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, good stuff.
Well, I think the paradigm is changing. I think we're in that, you know, the benefit we have now, which we didn't have 20 years ago when we did our training 25 years, the young generation's different. They're smarter than we were. They're able to pick things up very fast. That's why the cataract coach stuff's so popular, which, by the way, is like there's a huge amount of glaucoma in cataract coach every week. But they learn things by video, and they learn it very fast. It's amazing. And I think that the younger generation is more amenable to rethinking diseases like glaucoma and rethinking what should the protocols be. And maybe the old paradigm is meant to stay in the past.
Yeah, they have resources that we didn't have, right? I mean, like, we couldn't just go watch a bunch of videos on iTube. But there's something about that. Like, the value of fellowship for me was seeing someone do something well over and over and over again.
Right.
And because I'm an intuitive surgeon, I would see it and then I would like replicate that, you know, and there have been times where, you know, I'm like, you know, I've had to do some things and I'm like, I know how to do this. Let me just watch a couple of videos of this,
right,
you know, and
pick up some tricks.
Yeah, let me just remind myself, like, how to, you know, it's rare, and I'm certainly at the point of my career where if I don't feel like I'm the best to do something, I will send it to somebody else. But yeah, no, there, it is different. I agree, and you know, and it's I have a bunch of Zoomers that work for me, and it is as technicians who like, it's amazing how they get it.
Oh, for sure.
And like, you know, they pick up gold montanometry like that. And, you know, as long as they can get out of their own way, you know, there's hope for the future of America.
No, for sure. You know what it is? It's the generation also grew up like we did, playing video games. Hand-eye coordination is great. I could teach any of these people if you're enthusiastic and hardworking. Even if you're right out of high school, I'll teach you how to do a beautiful Goldman application or even other small procedures in clinic. You can do them.
Yeah. No. So how's your, I mean, are you enjoying just doing all your own surgery? Well, you were doing all your own surgery anyway.
I always did the two in parallel. So I've been in private practice this is my 25th year. And so then I did academics for 22 years together, side by side. I got a kind of lucky position there.
Yeah.
But now I'm actually, it's, you know, listen, every so often you got to change gears.
And if so you weren't having residents do your cases.
My private practice was always private practice. Okay. No residents, no fellows. And then I was with the residents of the big county hospital where we did everything. I mean, for example, someone asked me, like, have you ever done an almond valve? They asked me, it's like, I said, I've done more than 1,000. Because of the county hospital, there's at least one NVG case a week that we're doing.
Right. Amazing.
At a minimum, at least one NVG case per week. So we're doing that. And then on top of that, like, yeah, I actually learned by watching the Cattle Coach videos. You learn so much more.
You really do. I think we've all picked up on things just, you know, watching your videos and watching, you know, just even if it's just a subtle something, like, you know, doing a stitch, you know, backhanded in that situation, or doing, you know, like, it just these little things, you know, like, you know, you know, when I do the iDose on a left eye, I'll use my left hand because I want the iDose to be close to 12 o'clock. So the lid covers it, you know. You know, I mean, like, but little things like that, that you see someone else do and you're like, I can do that. I can operate with my left hand.
But that's our commitment to lifelong learning. That's because you and I were the types where I always want to learn something new. Always.
Yeah. No, it's like, you know, crack, you know, it's, you know, we get addicted to new things. And, you know, and I would tell my fellows, I'm like, you know, if I'm doing the same thing I'm teaching you 10 years from now, like, just shoot me. You know, like, this is like, you know, this is, so Brian Francis and I and Jeremy Tan wrote a book, just Migs, you know, book, you know, very practical book. And, you know, and it was in the preface, I remember sort of talking with him, like, well, how are we going to preface this? Because things are changing as we're writing the book. Things are getting FDA approved and things are starting.
Right.
To, like, we had we just finished the second edition. It should be out hopefully by Academy. And, like, we had to get rid of all kinds of stuff that was in the first edition, like the gold shunt and, you know, abaxter canal plastic. We're like, no, that's not MIGS. Like, now MIGS is really defined, yeah. You know? And so we edited everything. But even in the beginning, in the preface, I was like, you know, this is a template. This is a trellis of basic principles in order to do minimally invasive glaucoma surgery. Mm-hmm. The vine will be very different. The vine will constantly be evolving.
But right.
The trellis is there, right?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with all of ophthalmic surgery. There's the sense of the microscope and the sense of where you are. And, you know, when you're working in the angle, like, the landmarks are the landmarks. They're not ever going to change. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, the, you know, we're not going to have to do Vulcan eye surgery. You know, it's the landmarks are the same, you know? And so, you know, once you have that and you just own that and you're just, you know, you're not going to screw, you are not going to implant anything in the ciliary body ever. You know, that was a first year. That was a 2012 problem. You know, I wish, you know, like, you know, I still see some of those, but, you know, yeah, I see more hydrus in the ciliary body than the eye stents, but it happens, you know, and nothing against the hydrus, but this is what I see. But, you know, once you get that, then you have that foundation to build on. So that any new thing that comes out, you're like, yeah, I got this, you know, this is, I live in this. This is my space, man. This is my home.
Of course.
You know? And, like, I can do this, you know, and you know, it's, and that's the, that was the, pre, you know, kind of the premise, like, this is all going to change, but it doesn't make the book obsolete. You know, it's not like it's going to have a 2-year senescence.
Well, the fundamentals are the same.
Fundamentals are the same, you know, and, you know, lots of light when you're looking at the angle, like, turn it up to 90%, mm-hmm. Turn the light up to 90%. It's like, oh my gosh.
So it's easier.
I see everything. I've done that with, I did that with some trainees. I'll be like, they'll be like, yeah, I'm just really struggling. I'm like, just beep, 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 beep. You know,
yep.
Try it now. Oh my gosh. That's it. That's all it took to turn the light up.
Yeah.
It's a miracle.
I had a trick on Cattle Coach recently. I had a video of someone just using a little tripan blue dye to stay in the TM. Like, there you go.
Yeah.
That was easy.
Slick technique, right?
Yeah, nothing to it.
Yeah, I mean, there does come a point, however, where, you know, lots of the coolest ophthalmology on videos is what we call recreational ophthalmology.
How so?
The reimbursement for cataract surgery keeps going down. Reimbursement for everything keeps going down.
Right.
Especially if you get the branded, I mean, if you're going to get it from a lab, the Tri-Pan Blue, okay. But, you know, Vision Blue costs money. I assume they're still making that. I haven't used it in forever.
$66.
Right. $66. Right. So, you know, you start, if you add that and a ring.
Yeah.
And
$120+ for the ring.
Right. So guess what? That case just lost money. You are now, it's recreational ophthalmology.
And extra viscoelastic too. Add that in there.
Extra viscoelastic. And the fact that it took you twice as long.
Right.
Or three times. As a standard phaco, right? So yeah. You know, so there's the opportunity cost, recreational ophthalmology. But why are you doing it? Because you want to help that patient, and it's awesome,
right?
Once a month at least, I'm doing an LP cataract, and you know what I do for those folks? I mean, you know, I'll often do them in my office, in my OBS.
Okay.
I own the femto there as well as the one at the hospital. I lease it to the one at the hospital to them. And I'll just like heavily discount it. Sure. You know, I don't charge nothing. You know, in fact, I had a guy, a tattoo artist that had an LP cataract, that like a traumatic cataract. And I'm like, can you like paint me something? Paint me like something. Cool. Like make me, because he's an artist. I'm like, make me a painting.
And you don't want to get tattooed.
No, that's not going to happen. Although both you and I, if we put a little tattoo, right, we put a little tear here and we hung out in the, I don't think anyone would mess with us.
Wearing tank tops.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that we would be left alone, but I mean, like I love doing femto in dense white cataracts to the point where I'm just like, cause it's better. Yeah, like you want to give people the best surgery, you know, freaking Tri-Pan Blue. And like, that's not the best surgery. It's good. And we've gotten good at it. We've done it hundreds of times, but just use the femto in those cases. It's way better, you know? And yeah. Like, you know, I eat it a little bit, you know, for those, you know, I mean, I try to make it so I at least cover the click fee, but you know, like that's awesome. Like that is so satisfying. Cause then you're like, oh, this is now a routine case.
Well, this is why that, you know, the insurance companies and Medicare can take advantage of us, because we just love what we do.
We love what we do, and we want to do the right
thing. The example you showed is you would do it for free. Your net profit zero.
Yeah. And you know what? Instead of it taking 20 minutes, it took 10 because I used the femto, you know, and or whatever. I don't want to make up times, but you know, I mean, it's, and then it just allows me to do more that day. But it really, in the end, what is it about? It's about that patient. You know, I can't wait to see. This was last week. I can't wait to see what he paints. It's going to be interesting. I told my clinic director, I may not be able to put whatever he paints like up anywhere. You know,
take it home, store it in your basement or your attic.
I saw his book of tattoos and of like his pro. And I was just like, yeah, you know, you're gonna have to work on something else.
A little too easy, huh? Well, that's awesome. Well, you. The I had a fantastic, like, by the way, we've been talking for an hour. I can't believe it.
Is that amazing?
You have a passion and a zest for this. Anytime I see your name, I'm like, all right, let me hear what he's got to say, because he's gonna talk from the heart and shoot from the hip.
It's true. It's dangerous. I'm not safe, but I am fair, and I am earnest, and I'm honest, and I'm passionate. I just love, man. How blessed are we to do what we do?
I'm thankful every day to be an ophthalmologist.
I like start to cry sometimes in front of patients. I'm just like, I can't believe I get to do this for you. Like, I'm just overwhelmed that I get to do this for you. And you know, I love every second of my life.
Yeah, especially those light perception cataracts. I mean, that's what got me interested in ophthalmology in the first place in med school. Patients with bilateral white cataracts. I thought, I just witnessed a miracle. A little.
Yes. Bit. We you know, it's like, and you almost know when people ask, you know, well, what do you do for living? Like, I never say, oh, I tell people what I do for a living when I meet them for the first time until they ask me, because it's like, what do you say? Well, I make the blind, by God's grace, I make the blind see. <You know? laughs> which is like, oh, okay, I guess you win. You know, it's like, no, that's not what it's about. But it is kind of like, it's extraordinarily humbling.
Yeah, we're blessed. This is why I've been thinking, like, how can I ever retire from this? What would I do with myself?
Right. Oh, right? Yeah. You read all these blogs about, like, people taking early, doctors taking early retirement, physician burnout. And I'm just like, burnout. Like, I don't want it to end, you know?
Right, I'm far away from that, too.
God's going to have to take me out of this game, you know? We need to do this again for sure. This has been fantastic, and you know, you need content, and you know,
you're too funny. You know? This has been fantastic, and I want to thank you so much. I definitely appreciate you spending this last hour with us.
Appreciate you, brother, and I look forward to seeing you at ASCRS. And let's come up with some mischief there. That'd be great.
Let's do it. And I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new podcast every single Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find the podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, a new Cataract Coach video every single day. And you know, Cataract Coach is not just cataract. It's cataract, glaucoma, cornea, and refractive, everything anterior segment. Plus, now we even have retinarounds.com. We got our retina channel with Dr. Pradeep Prasad, a new video every day as well. So until next time, I'll catch you later.